Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Well, today, in this hour, we're going to devote the entire time to the emerging disaster at Fukushima and also its implications worldwide for the future of nuclear power and the future of global warming. Did you know that the utility in Tokyo estimates that it may take 40 years to clean up that disaster at Fukushima? And meanwhile, they are overwhelmed by the task in front of them. They now admit that up to 300 tons of radioactive water has been spilled into the ocean, and perhaps many times that number. In fact, they don't even know. This is how bad the situation is. They don't even know how much radioactive water is spilling into the oceans. Not to mention the fact that workers are paralyzed because of the enormous radiation fluxes throughout the area. You would get a lethal dose of radiation walking into the Fukushima site, making the needed repairs. And that's why even robots have been proven to be ineffectual. The state of robotics right now is so primitive that we don't have robots that can turn a screwdriver, that can pound a nail, that can turn a valve. That's the sad state where we can't sacrifice workers going into lethal radiation field. Workers are useless, and so it's painstakingly slow trying to reestablish control over the Fukushima reactor. Not to mention the fact that ordinary rainwater is causing a tremendous fiasco at the site because it too is washing radioactive waste into the ocean. In fact, TEPCO, the Tokyo utility, has this rather strange cockamamie scheme to build a wall of ice. That's right, a wall of ice, the size of which has never been done before, in order to prevent some of the rainwater from washing radioactive waste into the ocean. But with us today to talk about Fukushima and also the larger implications of nuclear power is Michael Marriott. He's the head of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, one of the main clearinghouses concerning nuclear issues in the United States and also around the world. And so we're also going to talk about the fact that Germany and Switzerland have pretty much thrown in the towel and they are phasing out nuclear entirely. Italy and Japan are teetering. Meanwhile, France, Russia, and the United States are barreling straight ahead into nuclear energy. And the question is, what is President Barack Obama doing about it, given the fact that he has pledged support for commercial nuclear power, but the utilities are gun-shy? Wall Street is hesitant to put its money behind nuclear power plants that may be obsolete by the time they go online and are very expensive. And also, we have the tragic images from the Philippines, where we had this monster typhoon, one of the largest ever recorded in the history of science, obliterating the central part of the Philippines. And the question is, what could have happened if we had a nuclear power plant? If we had a nuclear power plant in the path of this gigantic hurricane? Because after all, we had a tsunami that hit Fukushima, and we now know what happens when a nuclear power plant is within the gun sights of a tsunami. All hell breaks loose with three simultaneous meltdowns. But what might have happened if we had a nuclear power plant right in the gun sights of this monster hurricane, which devastated the Philippines, causing so much human agony and suffering? Well, once again, our special guest is Michael Marriott. He's from the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the latest developments concerning the Fukushima reactor and what does it mean for global warming and for the history of nuclear power worldwide. Will nuclear power save us from global warming, or will it make things worse? Well, once again, our special guest today is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And today we're talking about nuclear energy. What's the status of the Fukushima disaster? What might have happened in the Philippines if there was a nuclear power plant within the gun sights of this gigantic, monstrous typhoon? And also global warming. Will nuclear energy save us from global warming? These are the questions we're going to be asking Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, one of the main clearinghouses concerning nuclear energy. Well, with us on the line is Michael Marriott of NIRS. So, Michael, first of all, tell us, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is the acronym for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization that was founded in 1978 to sort of help be the network center and sort of coordinating center for the what was then and is today a very decentralized grassroots movement for safe, clean energy and against nuclear power. And over the years, we've evolved. We now initiate campaigns, and our goal has expanded a little bit, too, in that we are working very hard to build the nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future that our planet both needs and deserves. You can find us at www.nirs.org.
Okay, so Michael, let's now talk about the Fukushima disaster, which is still ongoing. And first of all, tell us a little bit, sum up what exactly happened during the accident, and tell us about the state of the reactor today.
Well, back on March 11th, 2011, people across the world were woken up, at least those of us in the Western Hemisphere, with news that there had been a major earthquake off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami, and that was followed by a loss of electric power, not surprisingly, to a bunch of nuclear reactors, three of which at the Fukushima Daiichi locale began melting down. The fourth didn't melt down because there was no fuel in the reactor at the time. And two other reactors at the site, which were separate, they were physically separated from the other four, experienced a number of problems, but ended up at least not melting down. So what we had was a scenario that I don't think anybody working in this field had ever envisioned, three nuclear reactors melting down at the same time, coupled with severe problems at four reactor fuel storage pools, which were located at these sites. And we had a series of hydrogen explosions, which blew off the top of the reactor buildings, created all kinds of mess. And so now, approaching 3 years later, that's what we still have, three reactors that have melted down with the molten fuel somewhere underneath them. The authorities and the utility involved, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, they don't know exactly where that molten fuel is, too radioactive to try to get to, of course. And then we have, even though, this has happened, quite a long time ago, even though a lot of the fuel is still on the bottom of the, somewhere underneath the reactors, everything still needs to be kept cool. And so TEPCO built sort of a makeshift cooling system that runs through these reactors that leaks. And the large amounts of water run through, become, through the various reactors, it becomes radioactive, it leaks into the groundwater, and rainwater from obviously from rain. Fukushima sort of at the bottom of a hill. Rainwater comes down the hill, runs through the plant. It becomes radioactive. And pretty soon they notice that immense amounts of water are actually coming through that site, becoming radioactive, and moving on into the nearby harbor.
So, Michael, the main worry there is that highly radioactive wastewater could then pour into the harbor and eventually affect China, Korea, and perhaps other Pacific nations. So what's known about how much radiation is actually flowing into the water, and how dangerous is that?
Well, it's not clear, at least to me, how much radiation we're talking about. We know how much water we're talking about. It's something like 400 million gallons a day flowing in there. The water, this is not, you know, highly molten fuel going, so, you know, the water's picking up radiation. So the radiation levels are you know, not considered highly radioactive. But what happens is that there's a current that tends to keep the reactor, sort of a circular current in the harbor, and water tends to just sort of go around in a circle there, and the Japanese officials have used that as a you know, nothing more than excuse, really, to argue that water and the radiation, in particular radiation, has not gone beyond the harbor. And of course, that's absolute nonsense. Water is going from there into the Pacific Ocean, probably not as much as some people think, but certainly a lot more than the Japanese government seems to think. Fish come into the harbor and swim back out again. They're not really deterred by this you know, circular current. The other forms of, you know, sea life come in and out, and so it's very clear that, in fact, all of this, the radiation that has been coming down in the last couple of years and continues to come down is going out in the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, you know, and the question is, what are the impacts? What will be the impact? Pacific Ocean is a big place, and you know, even this amount of water is pretty small compared in volume compared to the entire Pacific Ocean. But
now,
certainly, an effect on seafood and the other factors.
Now, the utility has suggested some rather unorthodox ways to contain all this rainwater. One is to build a wall of ice that is import lots of refrigerators to basically freeze the ground so that you build up an artificial barrier against all this rainwater, which is washing this radiation into the harbor. What are your thoughts about this? It's never been tried before on this kind of scale.
Right. Well, it was actually a process I'd never even heard of before, although I looked into it a bit, and it has been used as a blocking mechanism in a few places in the world, although, as you say, in a much smaller scale. I have yet to talk to somebody who thinks this is a good idea or who thinks it will work. But obviously, you know, when there's somebody willing to sell something, you know, somebody will buy it, I guess. I think this idea really is more evidence that Tokyo Electric Power is in over its head. And, you know, this is a company, it's an electric utility. They made their money by selling electricity. This is not a major engineering firm, and I think that shows. And I think that's behind some of the recent efforts we've seen to, you know, bring some more international experience in to Fukushima to help out with this accident, because it's pretty clear that, you know, Tokyo Electric Power itself is floundering.
Now, some people have said that if there is another earthquake, it doesn't have to be a big one, even a minor earthquake, it could tip the reactor over, and the accident can start up all over again. So what are your thoughts about the fact that earthquakes happen all the time in Japan, and it wouldn't take much to tip this reactor over? What are your thoughts?
Right. Well, I'm assuming you're talking about the Unit 4 reactor there, which was the explosion that hit that reactor sort of crippled the building, sort of put it at a slant. I mean, you know, all the reactors there are in pretty bad shape, and if you want to talk about, you know, which reactor, you know, we still believe is the most dangerous, it's Unit 3. But Unit 4 has gotten the most attention. And they have put some effort into bolstering that the structure of that reactor. They had to do that for two reasons. One is that obviously the building was in very sorry shape and you know, noticeably leaning. Two is that they decided that that's the building because that building had not experienced a meltdown. There had been no fuel in the reactor core itself. That would be the starting point for cleanup, and so this month is when they're planning to begin removing the fuel from the fuel pool in that building. So they had to bolster it up quite a bit. They claim, they meaning the utility and Japanese authorities, claim that it could withstand at least a direct 6.0 earthquake. But I don't know if they're right or not, and I hope we don't find out. But, you know, as you say, you know, this is an earthquake-prone place, and I think it is better to get the fuel out of this building as soon as safely possible, before the next one hits, because in Japan, you're sort of always waiting for the next one to hit.
Right. In fact, just recently there was a 5.5 earthquake that rattled Tokyo. Quite a few people were shaken out of bed, in fact. It was so great. And that was just right outside Tokyo. Now, some people say, well, why don't they simply send in workers and robots and just get rid of this melted core, and why don't they just repair the whole operation? But tell us about the conditions that the workers have to work in, given the fact that it's highly radioactive, and robots have proven to be a huge disappointment.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, these are unprecedented conditions. I mean, we've never tried, you know, at Chernobyl, which is the major nuclear accident before this one, 1986, it exploded. The Soviet Union at the time, I mean, there were 600,000 people. They became liquidators, and their job was to run up. They could stand up for about 15 seconds and take, you know, and move some debris. 600,000 people, and they have been exposed to a very high risk of cancer. A lot of them have died from it since. At Fukushima, they don't have liquidators. They have utility employees and contractors and subcontractors. But yet the conditions, the radiation levels where the core is, where underneath the building, are just as comparable as Chernobyl. In some ways, it's probably harder because you've got, as we said, we had three simultaneous meltdowns. We've got three reactor cores that cannot be approached by people. And you can't even get to the core in a protective suit. I mean, you have to be away from it. And meanwhile, you have so much debris throughout what's left of these buildings that the robots they send in find it really difficult to maneuver around. I mean, they did get some in. I've seen some photos of inside the buildings, and some of the floors actually surprisingly look almost normal, but they try to get anywhere near where the fuel is, and they're blocked, and the cameras go bad. The radiation levels, the radiation film, of course, doesn't work well together. So it's a monumental, unprecedented task, and it's going to take decades before this is.
In fact,
this story is over.
The official estimate is 40 years. 40 years, an estimate made by the utility itself. So we're going to be agonizing about this for decades and decades to come, right? Our grandkids are going to be learning about the cleanup operation.
Well, that's right, and I think 40 years may be optimistic, but when you look at the reality is we're almost 3 years out. They are just beginning this month to begin removing the first fuel rod from the first pool. That removal of the fuel rods from that pool, if all goes well, scheduled to take a year and a half. Well, we got three more fuel pools after that, one of which at Unit 3 is in a much worse condition. And then we got these reactor cores after that, and as I said, they don't even know exactly where the fuel is, and that's going to be extraordinarily highly radioactive for decades, centuries, really.
Okay.
So, this process, this is going to be with us the rest of our lives.
Okay, well, change the subject a little bit. Some people claim that no matter how bad nuclear is, there's something worse, and that is global warming. In fact, Dr. James Hansen, who's one of the leading figures pushing the global warming theory, has pretty much said that, perhaps the white knight could be nuclear power. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Dr. Hansen, along with three of his colleagues, recently wrote an open letter, what he called an open letter to environmentalists, urging us to reconsider and support new nuclear power as a means of addressing climate change. And Dr. Hansen is an esteemed climate scientist. The entire world owes him a debt of gratitude for his work on climate, and especially in effectively warning that we have to do something about climate. But climate and energy are two different issues. They're two different areas of expertise. And unfortunately, Dr. Hansen's expertise doesn't seem to extend to energy. Nuclear power is not a solution to climate change. It never has been. Even if nuclear power were safe, let's take the safety issue off the table for a moment. Even if nuclear power didn't create radioactive waste, we'll take that issue off the table for a moment. The reality is we couldn't build enough nuclear power plants to play any kind of meaningful role in addressing climate change in any kind of time period that would matter. And that's what's so puzzling about his argument. He wants us to build a lot of nuclear reactors between, and by a lot, I mean an astonishing amount, well more than has ever been contemplated over the next 20 years. And what we're seeing in reality is the collapse of the nuclear power industry in the U.S. We're not seeing new reactors. We're seeing new reactor projects abandoned. In fact, just yesterday in Texas, two more proposed new reactors that were supposed to be part of this nuclear renaissance that was supposed to begin, around 2008, 2009. Two more reactors in north central Texas were canceled. The nuclear renaissance, at one point, there were plans to build more than 30 new reactors in this country starting this decade. We're down to four. And the utilities are realizing that they don't want nuclear power. They can't afford nuclear power. On an economic basis, nuclear power can no longer compete. And we're seeing that not only with new plants, which we knew were extraordinarily expensive, but even operating plants. In 2013 alone, we've had five reactor shutdowns of operating reactors. That's unprecedented. We've never had that in 1 year before. And we believe, NIRS believes, and a lot of other people believe, in fact, even Forbes magazine last week had an article on this, this is a trend that's going to accelerate. We're going to see more reactor shutdowns next year and the year after that. The nuclear industry is getting smaller, not bigger. Now, Dr. Hansen espouses new types of reactors, generally something called small modular reactors and integral fast reactors. These are reactors that exist on paper and in laboratories. They don't actually exist in the real world. There's never been a full-scale prototype built. And the idea that we are somehow going to take these reactor designs that exist on paper in somebody's lab and build hundreds, if not thousands, of them before the mid-century, when we have competing fuels that are much, much cheaper and just as clean, if not cleaner, than nuclear power, just makes no sense. And by just as clean or cleaner, I'm talking about solar and wind.
Okay, now, Michael, given the fact that well-known individuals are now jumping into the fray, Bill Gates recently jumped into this debate as well, talking about backyard nuclear power plants. Instead of having a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, he wants to have a nuclear power plant in everyone's backyard. So explain the logic behind backyard nukes.
Well, the belief is, and yeah, Bill Gates, this is another version of the small modular reactor. The idea behind them is that if you make them, you know, relatively small, and of course, yeah, they are much bigger than backyard. But if you make relatively small and you can make them modular, meaning that they can be cranked out in a, you know, in a factory instead of fully custom built at a site, that maybe you can make them cheaper. But the problem is the reason reactors got so large to begin with was, you know, the well-known phrase, economies of scale. The early reactors built in this country and everywhere else were very small. And the utilities quickly realized that they couldn't build them small and economically, so they ramped up the size. And you know, the same factor is going to hold, seems like it's going to hold true now, and I say seems like because, again, these reactors don't actually exist. They're, you know, dreams on paper. And they're also too late because when we want to talk about backyard power sources, well, we have them. It's called rooftop solar, and there's a rooftop solar system being installed in this country every 4 minutes now, 2013. By in 2 years, that's going to be every 90 seconds. We're going to have a new rooftop solar unit going up in this country.
Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And our special guest is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And we are talking about the future of nuclear energy, given the tragedy in Fukushima. And the question is, should we proceed with nuclear energy, given the fact that the accident at Fukushima is not over? It's still leaking radioactive water right into the ocean. And some small earthquake could literally tip it over. And then what about global warming? Will nuclear energy save us from nuclear warming, or will it simply make things worse? Find out in the second half of Exploration as we continue a discussion about the future of nuclear energy. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we introduced Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, and in the second half of Exploration, we're going to ask the question, will nuclear energy save us from global warming? Well, first of all, when you first site a nuclear power plant, you have to do an environmental impact statement. And for the most part, there are honest engineers and scientists who say that, well, if an earthquake were to hit this area, would the nuclear power plant survive? The problem is these well-meaning scientists and engineers don't really take into account the maximum credible scenario. Take a look at a gigantic tsunami that hit Japan, generated by a 9.0 earthquake. That kind of earthquake is off scale. They never considered the fact that a monstrous 9.0 earthquake, one of the largest ever to hit our shores, would create a tsunami which would overwhelm all the safety systems at Fukushima, causing a meltdown in three nuclear power stations. And then with regards to the Filipino typhoon, remember that once again, well-meaning people that are looking to place nuclear power plants everywhere on the surface of the earth don't take into account the fact that we could have typhoons on a scale never seen before in the history of science. In fact, if you take a look at the typhoon that hit the Philippines, you realize that it was not the wind that caused so much damage. It turns out the winds were about 200 miles an hour, some of the largest ever seen in the history of science. But the real damage to the central part of the Philippines was caused by a wall of water generated by the typhoon, which was very similar to a tsunami. And just like a tsunami, this wall of water basically pulverized everything in its path. So you can imagine the destruction that would have been caused if a nuclear power plant was in the wake of this gigantic typhoon. Well, once again, with us today is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and we're talking about the future of nuclear energy. Michael, where we last left off, we were talking about distributed energy. Instead of having one gigantic nuclear power plant in one place, some people are talking about distributing it over small nuclear power plants, sometimes called backyard nuclear power plants. So tell us a little bit about the history of this. And there's a certain person called David Crane, head of one of the largest utilities, Energy. Tell us about his position.
David Crane is the head of it. And you know, David Crane is not some anti-nuclear advocate. In fact, we've been fighting a proposed nuclear plant in Texas, a different one in Texas, that he initiated. Now, he got out of the plan. He got energy out of the project immediately after Fukushima. That ended nuclear power for him. But he recently said, he recently told Business Week magazine that distributed energy generation, and by distributed energy generation, we actually mean backyard power, rooftop solar, solar on top of, you know, Walmart warehouses and that kind of thing, small wind farm, even a backyard wind turbine, that is going to, in the same way, this is what Crane told Business Week, in the same way that cell phone use overtook landline use, distributed generation is going to overtake the current and traditional utility model of big baseload generation coming from dozens or hundreds of miles away, bringing power into your home. In the same way and in the same kind of time frame, this is going to happen. Now, if you think about that time frame, it's less than 20 years. Our electric system model is going to be completely different, and we are going to be relying far more on rooftop solar, on wind, on other types of renewables that can be done locally and nearby. And you know, not that the big power plants are ever going to go away, but they're going to play the subsidiary role. They're not going to play the major role anymore.
Okay, so Michael, let me ask you the question. Economy of scale was the justification for having so many monstrous units in the same place. That's why at Fukushima we had four reactors damaged right next to each other. But these backyard nuclear power plants that are roughly, I don't know, 15 by 15 feet, that you can literally dig into your patio backyard, where is the economy of scale there? Why are they economical when previously they said you had to have these multi-gigantic units right next to each other?
Well, you have to understand that their plan is not really to put a nuclear plant in everybody's backyard. In fact, the way they want to do these may be surprising to some people, but you would have an array of them at a site. So instead of building a single 1,000-megawatt power plant, which would be the roughly the norm today, you would build 100-megawatt power plants, and they'd all be hooked together. You'd still get the same amount of power. You still have the same concept of baseload energy that the utilities have relied on for many decades, but you'd be doing it in a somewhat different way. And the advantages of that, there are some advantages to that. For one thing, they would run these instead of with 10 different control rooms and 10 different groups of operators, with one control room and one group of operators. So they'd save a lot of money on personnel costs, not necessarily on safety, but on personnel costs. Now, there is a safety advantage in building smaller reactors with new design, because it is possible to, for example, under some of these designs, the reactors would heat up much more slowly than, in the event of an accident, for example, in the event of a power loss like Fukushima, they would heat up much more slowly, and you would have more time to counter the effects of that. So there are some built-in advantages to it, not enough, in our view, to overcome the disadvantages, and not enough, again, in our view, for us to believe that they can ever be economically competitive with a renewables industry that, where prices have been just absolutely plunging over the past decade, and we see no reason that they're not going to continue to fall.
Okay, so Michael, let's now talk about the larger international situation. Nuclear power is going to be phased out in Germany and also in Switzerland. They've had it. They've thrown in the towel. However, nuclear power is still thriving in France, Russia, and the United States. So tell us a little bit about what President Barack Obama is doing, because he is an announced pro-nuclear advocate.
Well, the international situation certainly, changed after Fukushima. As you mentioned, Germany and Switzerland have gone anti-nuclear. In Germany, in fact, has gone further than that, because they're not only closing their nuclear power plants, but they also have an avowed goal of going 100% renewable by mid-century or so. And they're working toward that, and it's a bumpy road to that end, but they certainly are well on their way. Italy, another country that has rejected nuclear power. Austria is another country. Ireland. So you have a big section of Western Europe, at least, that has rejected nuclear power. On the other hand, the biggest growth in nuclear power right now is in Asia. China, India are both actively building new reactors. Although we've had a big setback in Korea, which was one of the most pro-nuclear countries in the world just until recently, where over the past year they've had this immense scandals caused by the discovery of counterfeit parts being used at Korean reactors, meaning safety-related reactor parts that were not what they were supposed to be, not of nuclear grade. And it's been a big scandal. It shut down some Korean nuclear plants, and that coupled with Fukushima has caused a rethink there about nuclear power. Here in the U.S., President Obama's signature move on nuclear power was an $8.3 billion loan guarantee that he announced personally back in February of 2010. So well over 3 years ago, and that was to provide a taxpayer loan to the Southern Company to build two new reactors in Georgia at the company's Vogtle site. So here we are, almost 2014. That loan has still not been granted. There have been five extensions of the loan, and it's because the loan has to be, the terms of the loan have to be approved by the Department of Energy, which was the lead organization of the loan. They have to be approved by Southern Company itself, of course, and they have to be approved by the White House's own Office of Management and Budget. And what Southern Company has been looking for, what they want, is a sweetheart deal. They want extremely low, below-market interest rates, and they want assurance that taxpayers are going to take all the risk of the project. The Office of Management and Budget, to its credit, hasn't been willing to give them that. And so the loan is sitting now, hasn't been granted. And we've actually heard from inside the White House that they kind of wish the president had never gone out and made that loan offer. So we'll see what happens with that. We're actively fighting it, have been for years. Just tried to deliver 22,000 plus petition signatures against the loan this past week to the Department of Energy, and instead of accepting the petitions to give to Secretary Moniz, they were seized as a security threat. We tried to document the delivery by taking a photo. Security was called, and we were forced to delete the photo from our camera. So, you know, Department of Energy clearly is a little touchy about the issue. But unfortunately, the company involved, Southern Company, does have an out because they are building those two. Those are two of the four reactors that comprise the nuclear renaissance at this point. They're building this reactor because they are able, under state law, and this is not a law available in most states, but in Georgia, the ratepayers are basically being used as a bank for the Southern Company. In other words, Southern Company is collecting money to build these reactors that every time ratepayers in Georgia pay their electric bill.
Okay, now, Mike, let me ask you another question. President Barack Obama, however, closed the Yucca Mountains nuclear waste dump. That was supposed to be the nation's repository for nuclear waste. But now that it is basically closed, where are we going to put the nuclear waste?
Well, that's certainly the question of the day. And the answer is we don't know. There is currently legislation in the Senate Energy Committee, a bill called S-1240, that begins, and I, with the emphasis on begins, to answer that question, it would set up a new agency to deal with the issue, that they would take the radioactive waste issue away from the Department of Energy, which has not done a good job of handling it over the past decade. They would set up a new and so far not particularly defined consent process for communities that would find themselves with a proposal for a nuclear waste dump in their community. There would have to be some sort of consent. It's not clear yet what consent means, and it would set up what we are most concerned about is centralized interim storage of radioactive waste. And what that means is that they would take the waste from the existing reactors, from the dry casks that the waste sits in, and in some cases fuel pools, and move it to a centralized place that was just chosen not on any kind of safety grounds, not because it's a good place to put the waste, but because they can't think of anywhere else to put the waste, and the utilities want it off their property. The unfortunate reality is that such a place likely would become a de facto permanent waste dump, since nobody wants a permanent waste dump, and if somebody moves all the waste to somewhere anyway, there'll be a lot of pressure to make that a de facto waste dump. And if a permanent repository does come along at some point, then you got to pack all the waste up and move it again, which makes no sense either. We've called the entire concept Mobile Chernobyl, the waste is most dangerous when it's moving. While there are some potential problems while the waste is sitting at the reactor site, those are dwarfed by the potential problems of waste moving 60 miles an hour down a railway or highway. So the transportation of this waste is highly problematic. And yet that's the best concept they've come up with so far.
So there really is no long-term plan for nuclear waste in this country, then. That's what you're saying, huh?
That's exactly what I'm saying. The best that we have right now is the idea that we'll create a new agency and set up a new process. We're not much further along than that. And of course, the likelihood that even this bill is going to pass the Congress is slim, because we have that's been on the Senate side. On the House side, where the Republicans are in control, they can't seem to give up on Yucca Mountain, and their interest is in passing a bill to restart the Yucca process, reopen Yucca, regardless of the fact that no bill like that is ever going to get through the Senate, as long as the majority leader is Harry Reid from the state of Nevada, who's made his entire career opposing this project, and opposing it pretty darn successfully.
Okay, and also let me ask you about the economic and political dimensions of this. Some people say that Wall Street, which you would assume to be pro-nuclear, is actually very ambivalent about nuclear, because when you look at the numbers, nuclear power is still very expensive, and given the fact that there's a lot more natural gas through fracking and also the shale oil, the noose around America's neck is not quite so tight. And so some people are saying that perhaps that's not the economical way to go. But what are your thoughts about how the investors are looking at nuclear?
Well, sure. I mean, you have to remember that Wall Street is agnostic on everything, except how much money they're going to make. They don't care what the technology is. They care what the bottom line is. And in that sense, Wall Street has been, perhaps the greatest friend the anti-nuclear movement has ever had. And I say that not entirely facetiously. The reason President Obama had to announce a taxpayer loan for new reactors in Georgia was because of fears that they wouldn't be able to raise money any other way. That's the reason the entire loan program was established back in 2005 under the Bush administration. And thus far, Wall Street has shown zero interest in new nuclear power, new traditional type of nuclear power. They haven't been willing to loan money to utilities to build new nuclear reactors. They've shown little to no interest in the small modular reactors that are said to be the future of nuclear power. But one thing that they have shown a lot of interest in lately is the status of operating reactors. And there have been a lot of reports from utility analysts over the last couple of years that we certainly read regularly other investors read regularly, that try to predict which will be the next reactors to close before their time. And that's sort of where Wall Street is right now. It's not about building new reactors. It's trying to get out of existing reactor projects before they fall apart. It's a real shift, and it is just another indication, I think, that the nuclear power industry is beginning what will be a somewhat long-term collapse, but perhaps shorter than we might have thought, even 5 or 10 years ago. The nuclear industry is stumbling toward its end, and it's going to be replaced. And we have a real shot at building the nuclear-free, carbon-free future that we've been fighting for so long.
Okay, now also we mentioned the backyard nuke. However, about 5 years ago, there was a big propaganda push to try to get a new generation of gas-cooled reactors and using different kinds of cooling methods rather than looking at water, the inherently safe nuclear power plant. Then Fukushima happened, but what's happening now? Are the utilities putting forth a new generation of large reactors that are based on gas, that are based on technology rather than fuel rods, but pebbles perhaps? What's happening with that so-called renaissance?
Right. Yeah, you're talking about what's usually called the pebble bed modular
That's
reactor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they actually, there was at one point some momentum in South Africa to try to get one of those built. That seems to have faded. One of the companies involved in that project was Exelon, which is the largest nuclear utility in the United States. But we haven't seen any interest among utilities in the United States of actually building any of these kinds of reactors, inherently safe or not. And even if there were, again, these would be too far away, because you have to understand that to build a new design reactor, you have to first get a design certification from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a reactor that is relatively known to the NRC. In other words, it's either a pressurized water reactor or a boiling water reactor, which are the two types we use in this country today. That certification process takes about 4 to 7 years. For a new design, it's completely new that they've never dealt with before, and I can tell you I can raise 10 questions about the pebble bed reactor right off the top of my head after studying it, ever so slightly a decade ago. There's a lot of questions to raise about these kinds of reactors, and the certification process is going to take, a decade. And utilities, with nobody, no utility saying, hey, we want to build these if you can get that certified, there's no incentive for them to go ahead and spend all that effort to get the certification. You got to have a customer before you're going to spend the kind of money and effort it takes to go through the process. The process is pretty rigorous, and it should be for nuclear power plants. So, there's just no impetus, again, with the level of competition to nuclear out there right now. There's just no impetus for any rational firm to pursue that.
Now, the bureaucratic wheels are turning very slowly to begin the process of relicensing nuclear power plants after a hiatus since Three Mile Island. But what you're saying is basically it's going to be old wine in new bottles, nothing really new. And we're just going to have the same old if we have a so-called nuclear renaissance, except we're not going to have any new models. Is that right?
Well, we're... as I said, the nuclear renaissance right now is four reactors in Georgia and South Carolina, and they're both Westinghouse AP1000 designs, they're both still pressurized water reactors. I mean, I think the apt comparison of them to the ones that are currently operating in the U.S. is that they're the difference between a 1965 Chevy Impala and a 2014 Chevy Impala. The 2014 model is got airbags and seat belts and a whole lot of safety features that the 1965 model didn't have. So of course it probably gets better gas mileage too. So of course it's better. Is it good enough to compete in a world where solar power and wind power prices are plunging, and probably not. And is it inherently safe? By no means. Somebody driving a 2014 Impala can, unfortunately, still get killed in a traffic accident. That's the reality. That's the reality of this new design too. So on the new reactor front, the issue is that there's nothing new going on. On the relicensing, we have today in this country right now, we have exactly 100 operating reactors, although one of those, Vermont Yankee, is closing early next year. About two-thirds of those have already been relicensed by the NRC. Very difficult to challenge a relicensing. And the relicensing, the original licensing gives the utility the right to operate the reactor for 40 years. The relicensing adds 20 years onto that. Look, there are some major relicensing battles going on right now, one of them being Indian Point, just outside of New York City, which does not have a license, an extended license, in the state of New York, and a number of environmental groups are, I was going to say in trial over this, that they're actually in a Nuclear Regulatory Commission adjudicatory proceeding over this, and they actually have a not much chance of winning there, but they have a good chance of winning at some state agencies where new water permits need to be handed out before Indian Point can operate with a renewed license.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, our special guest today has been Michael Marriott, head of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service. And we've been talking about Fukushima and the aftermath. And the question is nuclear power going to be the way of the future? Good day.